What's today? Thursday?
Yes, sir.
March 31st, right? Time flies when you're having fun, doesn't it? Just to couple of things. When you come up to testify, you'll notice that there is a pig on the counter. No, Refine, I'm not talking about you. However, you will be contributing, I'm sure. That is our acronym, Piggy Bank. And so if you use an acronym, and it's the written rule, by the way, so if you say it first as far as what an acronym stands for, like Office of Community Housing and Services, then and then use the term OHCS, then see, you wouldn't have to pay the pig. But if you just said OHCS, then you'd have to pay the pig. But, so anyways, I just warn you about that. Secondly is that the agenda this morning is all about the Energy Trust and the Public Purpose Charge. It's an informational hearing for our committee. Just to give you a little rundown, we're going to ask Lee Beyer and Rick Willis to come up and just talk a little bit from the PUC perspective about Senate Bill 1149 from the 1999 legislative session. That's what created the Energy Trust to begin with, or the Public Purpose Charge, I should say. And they're going to spend about 5 to 10 minutes on an overview. Then we'll have Margie Harris is going to give us a little overview and update on the Energy Trust. And great, nice to see you, Representative Anderson. Thank you for being here today. And then we have six categories for spending, and then one other group that I want to hear from. And so we'll have Margie stay up and talk to us a little bit about the energy conservation programs that the Energy Trust is doing, and then the renewable energy programs that they are doing. And then we're going to hear from the Department of Energy. Both Mike Graney and I think David McKay are here. And then this large customer self-directed projects, and then we'll hear from the housing folks with the low-income weatherization programs and the low-income housing programs. These are all beneficiaries of the Public Purpose Charge. Did I mention the education service districts and the energy efficiency? I might have skipped over that. But anyway, I'm also going to ask Jeff Bissonette to come up from the Citizens Utility Board to just address a little bit about the ratepayers' perspective. And since ratepayers in the Pacific Power and the PGE service areas are who actually pay into this fund. So we invited the House Environment Committee to join us, and so we have Representative Anderson, the chair of that committee, is with us as well. So thank you, Representative, for being here. And
Representative Rosenbaum.
Well, yes, but she's here as an Audits Committee member. But we're glad to have her here as an Environment Committee member as well. So let's go ahead and get started. Lee, Rick, want to come on up?
Actually, for the rest of them, John Savage.
I was going to say, you're not Rick. What are you doing?
I'm here to pay the pig.
when Lee uses an acronym, you're here to pay the pig. I got it. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chairman of the Public Utility Commission, and as he just self-introduced, I have with me Commissioner John Savage, who is our representative on the Energy Trust Board, and he's here to answer all the tough questions, because before he joined us, he spent a little over 25 years with the Department of Energy, and he's probably the most knowledgeable person in the state on conservation matters. So, Mr. Chair, I want to start this outright. And it's the first time I've testified in front of a House committee, and I know that you always change the rules, so it's my pleasure to pay to testify.
We do collect money in this building any way we can.
I know the state is having a revenue problem, and I'm happy to help.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you asked me to give a brief overview of the public purpose funds and the history of that, as well as the Public Utilities Commission's role in that, and I'm happy to do that this morning. I'm going to start out with how we got to where we are now, and that takes us back to the 1999 legislative session, Senate Bill 1149, which I will tell you that I was one of the carriers of that legislation in the Senate, one of the leaders, and I've grown fond of saying that it was a lot easier to pass the policy direction than it has proved to implement it. But that legislation, for those who are here and maybe those who have heard it since then, dealt with restructuring of our energy marketing system, delivery system, and it also dealt with how we deal with conservation and the procurement of renewable energy. I had little to do with the latter piece. When we were doing that, I was focused more on the restructuring side, but I do think that we did a nice piece of work. So, again, timing on this passed in 99. 2001 legislative session, we were a little concerned with the energy crisis that was facing us, so we delayed the implementation until March of 2002. So 2002 is actually when we started collecting the public purpose funds. Those funds are a direct bill on the customers of Pacific Core and Portland General Electric of 3%. The funds by legislation are allocated in percentage terms to five different sources. 56% of the funds are directed to energy conservation in homes and business. 17% are directed towards recovering the above market cost of renewable generation, adding renewables to the mix. 10% was directed towards energy conservation in schools. 12% was directed towards low-income weatherization, and 5% was directed towards low-income housing in general. The split of that goes out, the money, the low-income housing and low-income weatherization was directed to the Bob Repine's department, the Department of Community and Housing. I always get it wrong.
Housing Community Services.
I always get in trouble, Mr. Chair, and I didn't want to use the acronym because I'm out of change. The school money was directed through the educational service districts with the oversight of the Energy Department, and the largest portion of it, the renewables and the general energy conservation, was directed through the oversight of the Public Utility Commission. And again, the goal of these two programs were, one, to try to achieve conservation as cheaply as we could, because it's cheaper to save energy than it is to buy new energy, and secondly, to try to diversify our energy resource mix by adding in renewables. You can ask the why question, why renewables and why conservation, and I think the why is something that's on everybody's mind. It certainly was on my mind in 2001 as I was joining the commission and had to deal with the rapid run-up in energy costs. And the issue is that we're used to having very low energy costs in the Northwest, and the reason for that is fairly simple. We've got a lot of hydro resources, and that's served us well for a long time. Unfortunately, we've maxed that out, and so any new resource that we add is going to be more expensive, and it's just like making stew, you know, the more you add in, the how you change the ingredient. Just as an example, if you're looking at a unit of conservation, you're looking, depending on how you do that, somewhere around a penny and a half to 2 cents a kilowatt hour to do conservation. If you're adding a new resource, which is most likely to be natural gas fired generation or wind, at today's prices, you're looking at a minimum of about 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's about twice as expensive at the most expensive conservation than it is to add than try to conserve what you got there. So we're trying to keep the rates down is the reason for that. The diversification of the renewables, other than it just makes good environmental sense to try to add wind or biomass or some of the other choices there, the other reason is that the biggest choice that's or the biggest piece that's out there to add is natural gas fired generation. That's where everybody's going. 40% of the new electrical or the new demand on natural gas in the last few years has gone to fire power plants.
The problem with that is you're seeing the natural gas rates go through the ceiling, and particularly as we move off of a domestic demand for that onto a global demand, we're seeing increased international demand for that from China and India as those economies explode. That will continue, so it makes sense to try to diversify that mix. That's the policy that the legislature put in place with this bill. With regards to the programs, the conservation and renewables that we operate, the direction we had from the legislature, we being the PUC, was to look to a non-governmental entity to put that in place. And when we looked at that, and I have to say that I wasn't on the commission when they did that, so I inherited this one, but when we looked around, they found that there was not a non-governmental entity that existed that was willing to take it on in the big fashion. It's a fairly large program on an annual basis. So the commission, working with the industry and with the conservation groups like CUB and the Department of Energy, formed the Energy Trust of Oregon. I'll refer to it as the Trust or the Energy Trust here and after. And I think the logic of that is pretty solid. And essentially, what you're looking at is that while some will say that, you know, you see the 3% on your bill now and that's a new charge, it's not. The 3% was embedded since the 1970s, or an amount equivalent to that, in utility rates. Utilities, and it's still on the statutes, when there isn't this program in place, are required to do conservation and are required in their resource plans to deal with renewables. The policy choice that we made was to take that out of being buried in rates and put it directly on the bill where the customers could see they were paying for that, and to be honest with them and discuss that. The choice of going to taking it out of the utility companies and putting it directly into a nonprofit, it, to me, is pure good business sense. When we had it embedded in the utility rates, and they did, you know, they ran okay programs, but they were not consistent. But probably more importantly, think about it from your business perspective and see how interested as a business person would you be if the government came to you and said, what I really want you to do is sell less of your product because it's good for the public in general. So we separated that, and in essence, the message that the legislature has sent to the utilities and to the community is, to the utilities, we said, be the best electrical distribution companies you can be. Do what you're good at. To the Energy Trust, we've said, your job is solely to focus on conserving electricity, holding the rates down for people and delivering good services, and to assist in getting renewables into the resource mix. That's essentially the decision that we've gained them. Look back, the trust was actually formed in, I think it was 2000, but again, it didn't start, didn't have any money, couldn't get going until March of 2001. So it has roughly about 3 years of run-up experience. The first 2 years is typical of any startup and adding staff and doing that. Where we're at today is we have a board, and this is in the packet we gave you, that of membership that represents a cross-section of experts in conservation, business leaders and customers, and representation of residential customers on the board. So it's a good mix, and geographically it's spread across the entire service territory of Pacific Corps and PGE, which means we have members from Bend, Klamath Falls, Medford, Eugene, Portland. So we've got a good geographic mix there, and I think it's a good board. They implement those programs primarily through contracts that are bid competitively. The thing that we've tried, we being the commission, has tried to encourage them to do is not get directly into running programs themselves, because we wanted them to be nimble, and we didn't want a big staff there, but there is, I mean, frankly, when you're running a $50 to $60 million program, you need some people around there who have the technical knowledge to decide what's the right project, working with the board, and to monitor it and make sure it's delivered well so that we have accountability. They have a staff of about 35 people. Their offices, and Margie will go into this in more detail with you, are located in Portland, that are within a couple blocks of Pacific Corps and PG's headquarters, and I believe, as I recall, they're in the same building that the Northwest Power Planning Council is in. I did want to touch on one thing, though, just going back to conservation. One of the keys that we use and the other four states use in looking at and evaluating what the demands will be in the future is the power plans that the Northwest Power Planning Council puts out. They just put out their last or their most current plan, the fifth power plan, and one of the things that they commented is that there's the opportunity to save better than 2,800 megawatts of generation if we do good conservation. And you've seen that in the papers recently with the water shortage, saying we need to do this if we're going to keep the rates down. Might recall for some of us who were around in the early 70s in the McCall era, we went through that unplugging Christmas lights and that. We'd like to get that into a level system where we make those permanent savings and not. You'll hear about some of those as we go forth. So the results to date, and again, I ask you to remember that this is a startup company that's just sort of hitting into stability now. To date, the Energy Trust has helped over 50,000 Oregon customers, and through them, they've helped them save about $26 million in energy bills. That's enough electricity that's been saved to serve 48,000 Oregon homes. And it's been done at an effective level. The cost have ranged from 1.5 to 1.7 cents per kilowatt hour, which, as I mentioned a minute ago, is slightly less than half of the cost of adding generation. And they've helped finance on the renewable side 41 megawatts of wind facilities in eastern Oregon and a number of other projects. I'm not going to get into those because you want me to go fast. I'm going to let the trust cover their details.
That would be good. Maybe you could talk a little bit, go ahead and talk a little bit about the PUC oversight and sort of how that...
That's exactly where I was moving, Mr. Chair.
Right.
You provide good direction. Our oversight, then, is how do we take care of this? As I said, we created the trust and sort of babied it on its way, and we've been moving into a tough love phase, if you will. We adopted in the last year, we have them under a grant agreement that we have the ability to pull the plug on at any time. And we set forth last year some fairly strict benchmarks for production and their output measures, the kinds of things that as an audit committee you'll be able to get your arms around. They're in the packet in front of you. But how do we manage that when we set the things through? Well, our grant agreement calls for us to, one, we have on the board of directors, we have two ex-official members, Commissioner Savage and a senior member from the Department of Energy, to make sure that we have coordination between the state programs and make sure that we have input into every major project decision that's made on an ongoing basis. Then we have a requirement that they provide us with quarterly financial and program reports. In fact, not only written but oral reports. Every quarter they appear in front of the commission and discuss with us where they're going to go. In a startup, I should have said this first, one of the things we require of them is an annual plan along with a strategic plan that we can approve to make sure they come and make sure that they're moving in the direction that we believe is consistent with the legislative intent and what we think are good practices. They're required to have, in addition to those quarterly reports, they're required to have a standard independent financial audit annually. And one of the requirements we put in the grant agreement was after the first 2 full years of operation that they would have a management performance audit done by an independent party. We've just completed that, and I think that I signed the letters and you have copies of that. If you don't, they're on their way to you. And that report will go forward, or that process will be every 5 years henceforth. So we've got that process in place to not only have our own internal watchings of it, but watching on a quarterly basis, and then have an outside look financially every year, and from a management perspective every 5 years going forward. This is this spring, and I think it's this next month, we are actually holding, it's an evergreen contract, so we have the chance to review it every year. We're actually going to hold a public hearing on that to allow other people the opportunity to answer. The basic question is the public getting the bang for their buck out of the energy trust, and this is still the best way to do it. So that gets us to how we do that.
Maybe this gives you us an opportunity to help you.
It gives you an opportunity to have an input, and more importantly, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate where you're at, it gives the ratepayers who are paying the bill the opportunity to have a comment into the process.
I appreciate that. Lee, I just wanted to ask you real quickly about the benchmarks, because when I was navigating around on both the PUC website and on the Energy Trust website, nowhere was I able to find the benchmarks that the PUC has set for the Energy Trust. Now, is that an oversight, or is that because you've got it buried somewhere and you have to just navigate your way through and read 18,000 pages before you can get to it, or is that an oversight?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be embarrassed if they're not there, because I thought they were there, and buried is probably, I really don't like that term, but we're trying to make that website as friendly as we can.
Well, I saw the link that said that under the Energy Trust Union, it says benchmarks, but when I clicked on it, I could not get to there was a couple of more clicks that I did, but I never got to the benchmarks. Or maybe I was mistaken, what I thought were what you think the benchmarks are, and what I think the benchmarks are.
Well, Mr. Chair, I will make this commitment
anyway,
to you. When I leave this room, the first thing I do when I get back to my office will be click on that, and if I can't find them, they will be there.
Thank you.
I thought they were.
Okay, thank you.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any other questions for...
You've got the pro here who can really answer them.
I actually have a question. Thank you, and actually you answered most of my questions in your presentation, so I was very pleased because I had several questions about that. But regarding the public purposes charge, as you mentioned, that prior to Senate Bill 1149, that was embedded in the rates of either Pacific Core or PGE.
That's correct.
Customers. Was it 3%? Is it the same percentage that the public purposes charge is?
Actually, during the mid-90s, it was actually higher. They were running programs, part of the nature, I would guess about 4%. I'm guessing the period from about 93 to 97. One of the concerns which led to a consistent 3% was that the numbers went up and down. That there was, so there'd be periods of a lot of money going out there, and then there would be periods very little money going out there. So we had both below 3% and above 3% in the 90s.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up? And were there opportunities for ratepayers to weigh in on the types of projects that were funded through use of this money at the time, or was that dependent on the board?
That would be, we had to approve on the tariffs. The then commission approved all programs through tariffs, and so they had the opportunity through our normal public processes at the commission to come in and weigh in. They typically didn't, though. I would guess that PGE and Pacific's conservation people are very much in touch with their customers out there, and we're probably talking with them, with their commercial, industrial, and residential customers about the types of programs that they would like to see. But that would probably be more on an informal basis than formal basis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Infelder, I think you can direct that question most effectively when the time is right to Mr. Ken Cannon or Jeff Bissonette. Ken represents the industrial customers, and Jeff represents the Citizens Utility Board. And they have told me informally before that their feeling is that they have better access now than they had before, but I want to let them speak to that point.
Thank you. I appreciate your
response.
Mr. Chair. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to hate to show my ignorance like this, but I do it quite often, so I shouldn't be embarrassed. But the public purpose charge is leveraged only on investor-owned utilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, by legislative direction, it's levied only on the customers of Portland General and Pacific Core.
And is there any other investor-owned utilities in Oregon?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, there's Idaho Power, but the legislature practices religiously the Idaho exemption.
I think Representative Butler would probably say that when I part of Oregon.
Representative Butler is very aware of the Idaho exemption.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, I know that a lot of work and a lot of controversy went into the passage of SB 1149, or was it House Bill?
That's right.
Senate Bill. And actually, I think the chair and I were both on the committee that bill came out of in 1999. And it brought together a pretty unusual group of stakeholders to bring it forward. So can you tell me, was the public purposes part of this bill a crucial part of its passage, would you say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think the term is that the Senate Bill 1149 was artfully crafted. It was a true miracle of legislative compromise that had a broad continuum of interests represented, and every piece of the puzzle was critical to getting the jigsaw together.
Now, that's pretty well put. You know, we always hear of political science. Nobody ever talks about the political art. And what is politics but the art of the possible, right? Any other questions for Mr. Beyer? Commissioners, thank you very much. Oh, by the way, we didn't violate any public open meetings laws here, did we? And quorum problems with the two of you being here?
No, Mr. Chair, and I promise to report my quarter to the Ethics Commission.
So that was a quarter you put in there. It looked like a nickel from here.
Not if I got to get my glasses.
I didn't know the requirement was folding stock. So.
Well, you'll know next time. Thank you. Okay, I would like to then go ahead and Margie, if you would come up and give us about 5 or 6 minute kind of overview and update and that sort of thing, and then we'll let you get right into the two programs.
In the interest of good customer service, we're on
late. Oh, thank you.
Sometimes
can you
easier than
can I make copies of that? Is it a front and back draft? Oh, not the back, just the front?
Yeah, that's okay. An excerpt from a draft report that had them in it.
Great. I'm going to have Kelly make copies for us real quick. So thank you for bringing that. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Chairman Crummell and members of the committee, my name is Tom Foley. I'm the newly elected president of the Energy Trust. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about the work of the trust and the work we're doing for the customers of Portland General Electric, PacifiCorp, and Northwest Natural. Just as a footnote, Northwest Natural has recently contributed to the trust on a voluntary basis in an agreement with the commission. The benefits we apply specifically go to Portland General Electric, PacifiCorp, and Northwest Natural customers, but there are also byproducts that accrue to all of Oregonians that I'd like to touch on a little bit. But first, let me talk about the makeup of the board. The trust has an 11-member board, it's a volunteer board, and we have two ex officio members, Commissioner Savage and Bill Nesmith from the Department of Energy. Five of the board members are engaged in running their own businesses. In addition, we have two people at the vice president level of local industry. We have a retired vice president of Fred Meyers. We have an emeritus professor from the University of Oregon, one member from the Citizens Utility Board, and our retiring chairman, Steve Schell, who is a partner of a major law firm in Portland. We're now poised to elect two new members to bring our membership to 12 when Steve leaves the board this month. The new members are equally as competent. We have five members. We have members from Klamath Falls, Bend, and the Eugene area. It's a very diverse group. Everyone brings a different skill set to the work, and they work very hard. It's probably 3 to 5 days a month for board members. Some of us know the energy business quite well, including the issues surrounding conservation and renewable resources. Others bring legal, administrative, management, and other skills to the job. And as a group, we work very well together. We've established 8 standing committees on the board. We have an audit committee that deals with the financial and management audits. We have an evaluation and quality assurance committee that looks at how the programs are being implemented and what the results are and make sure that we can justify those. We have a finance committee that looks at the dollars and cents and make sure we're getting the biggest bang for the buck. We have executive director review committee, which is our link to the staff and the staff hiring. We hire the executive director. We have a policy committee that sets policy, that doesn't set policy, brings policy recommendations to the board. We have a committee that looks at staff benefits. We have a board nominating committee, and we have an innovation committee. The innovation committee has been a very interesting committee. It's made up of 2 board members, a member from the Oregon Department of Energy, and a member of the staff of the PUC. And in that committee, what we look at is the job that we're doing and whether we could do better by capturing synergies with other folks that are engaged in similar businesses. And we've developed, I think, a very good working relationship through that committee structure. We also, in addition to the committee structure, have 2 advisory councils, and these are for conservation and renewable, made up of outside experts. So all of the programs that the trust staff develops is vetted through these 2 councils before they come to the board. Typically, it's vetted twice through the council, once again after the board initial review. So the entire board, assisted by this committee structure and the advisory councils, sets policy, approves budgets, hires the executive director, and keeps a close watch on program development, implementation, and the outcomes of those programs. We take the responsibility of managing ratepayers' money, which is a lot of money, very seriously. Steve Schell, who's our retiring president, kept a copy of the Sarbanes-Oxley law on the table and waved it often and sometimes beat us with it if we didn't pay really close attention. So we have set up this structure to make sure that we understand where the money's going, we understand that the programs are effective, and to get the greatest bang for the buck of the ratepayers' money. I think we can show you that this structure has resulted in benefits to Oregonians that would not have existed without the trust. And others believe so. Also, we've only been in existence for a short time, as Commissioner Byers said, but we've garnered several awards. Just a couple I'll point out. We had the Oregon Restaurant Association Partner Award for supporting the Oregon Restaurant Association. And we've received award from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That's a Green Power Partnership Award. several others that I won't go into. Before I let Margie tell you the exciting details, I'd just like to take a minute to describe one of the byproducts of the work we do. There are several, pollution benefits, but the work the trust does becomes a fairly significant economic engine for Oregon. Roughly, we put $50 million a year into the Oregon economy, and that participants of the trust programs put in way more than that. But just as a conservative, if you say they match that, there's $100 million going into the economy. There's also, if the trust programs weren't there, there'd be $10 or $15 million of ratepayer money going out of the state at the margin to buy coal plants, power from coal plants, power from gas-fired plants, etc. So we've got over $100 million of economic activity being generated in Oregon from this, and over the course of the life of the trust, it's we're talking about $1 billion, and that's fairly conservative the kind of economic engine. As a corollary to that economic activity, you have much more efficient industries. You have hedges against future increases in fossil fuel prices. And you have industries that are going to be competing with industries from other states that are now more efficient. Blue Heron Project, for example, saved $5 million per year, bottom line, energy costs for that company. That will make them much more competitive in the markets that they sell into. I'll stop there and turn it over to Margie, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that the chair of the committee has.
Thank you. I had a question regarding the board appointments, because in the materials that was presented here, it says that the PUC initially appointed the board. So does that mean there's a different process when you talk about two replacement members? Right. How is that?
The initial appointments were made by the PUC, but we're a self-appointing board from that point.
And just a quick follow-up, are there geographic areas? I heard you talk about different areas of the state. Are there requirements to have representation from different geographic areas that are covered by either PGE or Pacific Corps?
I don't think there are any requirements. It's good policy, and we've attempted to abide by that. I mean, it just helps us a lot if we can get diversity. We have a little bit of a problem because we have so much committee work, and it's not cost-effective to bring people from Klamath Falls or from Bend to do that committee work. So you need a certain cadre of people from the Portland area that will be able to handle that work.
Thank you.
Okay. It is not to say they don't contribute. They contribute in other committees that don't require constant meetings.
Other questions? I do have one, Mr. Foley, and since you brought up the Blue Heron Paper Company, I'll go ahead and address that. I understand that there's about $5.4 million of energy trust dollars that went to that project.
That's correct.
There's also about a $2.5 million loan from the Department of Energy. And then there's a 35% tax break on their corporate income tax over a 5-year period. My question is this: first of all, would they, without the assistance from the state, would just to be able to save the money, would the Blue Heron Paper Company or their parent organization have made the investment into this mill?
Clearly, I can't answer that question for Blue Heron, but I can tell you my experience. I've worked since 1982. I was the head of conservation for the Northwest Power Planning Council. There are many, many industrial plants out there that could save power at a cost of, in the case of the Blue Heron, it was like a half a cent per kilowatt hour, the cost of the ratepayers' cost of saving that money. Very, very cheap compared to any other option you could get. But in industry, they have to compete at the corporate level for capital from other interests within the company, the major interest of which is making and selling product. And so it's very difficult to go to the boards and get capital to save energy. The budgets aren't fungible in many ways. There's always enough money to pay the bill, the electric bill, but it's difficult to get capital to save it because you're competing with so many different interests within the company. So I guess, Mr. Chairman and members, that my experience is that there are a lot of companies that don't make those investments, and I can only guess as to why, and you've heard my guess.
I would find it rather interesting that if they're looking at their bottom line and if it actually improves their bottom line, that they wouldn't address that. Before I go to you, Ms. Harris, is there any assurance so that, you know, if Blue Heron folds its tent and goes home, and they close the mill in Oregon City, we've made, you know, well, we're looking at 5.4 plus 2.5 plus tax breaks for 5 years. You know, we're talking probably about, you know, close to a $10 million investment here. They pack up their tent and go home and decide they're going to close the Oregon City plant. What's the disposition of that money? Is that going, you know, is there a requirement that the parent organization then pay the state back for those dollars, or is it just sort of, well,
yeah,
okay, that one didn't work, so let's go see what else we can do.
There is contractual language, and I'll let Margie address that, but the decision the board made was that that plant is far likely to remain as an operating plant with the investment we made than without the investment we made. And if Blue Heron, if that management structure leaves, we feel that there'll be another management structure come in and use that plant. It'll be an extremely highly efficient plant that now uses waste newspaper instead of mechanically pulping logs. And that's where all the energy savings comes from. So we talked about the issue that you're raising implicitly and made the decision to go forward because we thought it was a pretty decent bet. And could you address the contract?
I can add to your question,
sure,
if I may, please. If Mike Siebers were here, the president of Blue Heron, he would tell you unequivocally that they would not have made this investment but for the assistance you identified. They would not have had the resources. In fact, they were scrambling just to come up with the $2 million repayment of the loan. So they were strapped. And because of the scale of this particular project, the Energy Trust undertook extensive due diligence to look into the company, compare it to other companies of its type, evaluate the investment just the way that you are describing in terms of return to us and to the state. And we actually looked at what might happen if they close, the equipment would remain on site, or it would be salvageable, or it would, as Mr. Foley said, be available to anyone else coming in to operate a mill. So the beauty of the project is the low cost of the kilowatt hours that we acquired. And by no means should you take away that we're going to be doing projects of this scale on a regular basis. This was an extreme exception to the type of usual incentive amounts that are available. And the beauty of it was the low cost of the energy acquired.
Okay. So, did the board ever, let me go back to Mr. Foley for just a second. Did the board ever discuss the idea of, rather than setting these up for grants, particularly to for-profit operations, of setting it up as a revolving fund and maybe drafting the contracts so that when a company is actually realizing the savings, a repayment coming out of some of those savings. So, in other words, if a company is going to save a dollar, or they're going to save, you know, $5 million, and then $2.5 million of that is earmarked for coming back to go back into the, even if it's a 0% loan. I mean, I'm just curious if that was ever discussed by the board, or if it was just sort of decided that this would be money that would be.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't believe we ever did discuss that. Our focus has been on acquiring the energy savings, so that we avoid having to buy power at much higher costs. To the extent that it results in benefit to the customers, we've been counting that as a plus. And to the extent it counts as a benefit to the economic gains to Oregon, we've been counting that as a plus. There are a lot of byproducts to what we do, and if we can assist in achieving other positive benefits by working within our charter, we're gonna do that. And this was a great opportunity to get power at a cost of less than a penny a kilowatt hour, and improve the economic viability of that company. And that was what our concern was.
Thank you. Ms. Harris, would you like to go ahead and kind of talk a little bit about the conservation effort?
I'd love to do that. Thank you very much. I have my change purse ready, if necessary. Hope not to have to use it. Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. My name is Margie Harris. I'm the Executive Director of the Energy Trust of Oregon. I thank you very much for this opportunity to participate in today's discussion, and I'm pleased to be here. The sole purpose of the Energy Trust, as you have heard, is to reinvest the public purpose funds that are collected from Pacific Power and Portland General Electric through Senate Bill 1149, and separately, Northwest Natural has public purpose funds that we also administer at their request. Every day, we serve people throughout the state of Oregon by identifying opportunities for them to save energy and to utilize renewable energy. I was specifically asked to describe what we do, and what we do is motivate consumers, and we do that by offering them well-designed, very easy-to-use programs for every type of customer, many of whom have not historically had opportunities to participate in programs like what we offer. We also provide stable, consistent, and objective sources of information that help guide consumers in making wise energy decisions. We provide technical support, and we do that through the expertise of over 400 Oregon-based companies. There are a few from the Washington area also, who have gone through a certification process with us as a trade ally, and who also are oriented about our programs and hit the streets to market to their customers the benefits available through the Energy Trust. The financial incentives portion of our budget is the single largest portion. It represents 64% of our total revenues. And those monies go back in the pockets of the people who gave into the public purpose fund. We leverage opportunities with the Oregon Department of Energy, with all three utilities funders, and increasingly with many other diverse partners all through the state. I'm proud to say that we have low administrative costs, less than 11% of the total revenues that we receive, and in full accordance with the Public Utility Commission requirements. We also place a great deal of emphasis and scrutiny on our programs through the form of evaluations. We do several different kinds of evaluations at different stages of program development and implementation, and through that are consistently improving how we deliver our services. Why does all this matter? Well, from your perspective, the program participants are receiving direct benefits because they are gaining access to energy options and choices that help them. And how we help them specifically is to save an average of 20% on their utility bills. In some cases, it can be considerably more than that amount. We generate or receive a higher percentage of power from renewable energy sources that benefit individual consumers throughout the state. That gives them a hedge against rate increases in the future. What we know about energy is the price typically rises, and by controlling that cost variable, we keep more money available for other purposes other than energy. Those dollars are redirected into the economy and stimulate our economy throughout the state and also create jobs. It also translates into more productivity and a manufacturing business, allowing them to be more competitive in their business and for people in their homes and offices to also be more productive and to be more comfortable. Every Oregonian benefits from what we do. When we meet our energy needs from energy efficiency and from conservation, it's about half the cost of what it would be to acquire that same energy amount from fossil fuel generation and new power. We are also diversifying how we meet our energy needs currently and in the future. That mix is a combination of small and large-scale projects and a combination of energy efficiency and renewable projects working together. We capture what would otherwise be lost opportunities when we build houses and we build buildings to a higher energy efficiency standard, and we put in those buildings efficient equipment and efficient appliances that will deliver dividends to us for many, many years to come. Just in 2004, the Energy Trust generated $7.8 million in wages and added $1.3 million in new business income in our state. Those are to the points Tom was making earlier about the economic spillover benefits of the activities that we are responsible for. At the same time, we're protecting our natural resources and the environment. To date, our programs have reduced carbon dioxide emissions by 81,000 tons. That's equivalent to 174 million automobile miles not driven. We started, as you have heard, about 3 years ago, and we did so by collecting innovative ideas from best practices around the country. There are about 12 what are called system benefit charge organizations, not exactly like us, but similar to us in other parts of the country. So we looked at what they have been doing, and we gathered their best ideas and modified them and created our programs based on that experience. And as you also have heard from our inception, we have relied upon the expertise of the two public advisory councils that convene every month to help develop our strategies and to shape our programs. In a very short time, we've initiated 13 full-fledged major programs in the field, and we're rolling out our final two in the current year. Our management auditors very recently included in their comprehensive report a paragraph entitled Recognition of an Excellent Start, and I'd like to quote from that report. In a very short time period, the Energy Trust has formed an exceptionally strong and dedicated board of directors that has helped guide the accomplishments of the organization, hired exceptionally knowledgeable and dedicated staff, designed and rolled out an equitable mix of programs, begun the process of acquiring cost-effective energy resources and above-market price renewable energy, and has continually strived to improve operational systems and processes to be more efficient, end quote. That is from Tech Market Works, our independent
auditor. What page is that on?
Of the audit, it is the last comment in the executive summary of the management audit.
So that would be...
And the paragraph is headed Recognition of an Excellent Start.
It's also in the handout that we're together.
Thank you. Page 7. Okay, thank you.
What I am personally most proud of is the number and the diversity of customers who are attracted to our programs and participating. We have opportunities and financial incentives for residential customers who have never before had such opportunities. These include seniors and fixed income residents who live in mobile homes, people who rent apartments or houses. We provide them and the people who own their structures with incentives to upgrade their furnaces to be more efficient, to insulate their buildings, to light their buildings more efficiently, to change out old windows, and to install high-efficiency appliances. We also work with architects and engineers and residential builders on developments such as the 2,500 units that are envisioned at Villebois in Wilsonville. Also, Westland Investment Realty is a major partner of ours who owns and manages multifamily housing around the state, and D.R. Horton Home Builders. On the commercial side, we work with every size and every type of business. They are represented on our list of served customers when Julie Brandis was in our office from the Associated Oregon Industries. She turned pages and said, that's a member, that's a member, that's a member. And we are able to attract that participation because our programs are readily available and simple to benefit from. We've made improvements in small independently owned businesses and storefronts and mom-and-pop operations, as well as larger companies that you will recognize, including McDonald's, Lowe's, Nike, and Providence Hospital. On the industrial side, I'd say that our landmark attraction is the Production Efficiency Program. We were recently at a conference where we described that program, and it received a lot of compliments. This is a program designed for large manufacturing companies who produce wood products, pulp and paper, food processing, and metals and high-tech fabrication companies. We've attracted some of Oregon's most prominent businesses and helped them cut costs at a time when they need to do so most. Included in this list is Douglas County Forest Products. We've already talked about the Blue Heron Paper Company, Hewlett Packard, and others who are examples of large-scale projects completed. We like these projects because they are high-volume savings at low cost, and they have so many other ripple effects that benefit business. We can also boast about the two largest solar electric installations in the Northwest. One is here in town at Kettle Foods, and the other is at the two Pepsi bottling companies based in Klamath Falls and Lakeview. I'm looking for a healthy food operation next. We got the chips and we've got the pop, right. Mm-hmm. At a community level, we also work with local municipalities. Most of where the popular programs have been enhancing equipment in municipal sewage treatment and water treatment plants. We also have...
Let me ask you a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that I've found, I've got a partial list of some of the PPC projects, public purpose charge, and I see that Pepsi-Cola in Cape Falls is on there. So from the solar electric system that they now have in place, they are producing all of the electricity that they need to run that entire plant. Is that correct?
I don't think all. I would be very surprised if it were all.
Is it 50%? Is it?
I think it's variable. I think the output on that was 227,000 kilowatt hours, which is almost double what we thought it would produce because of the locations in the southern part of the state. Hmm. So it is a highly efficient project, and because of the sunlight falling in that particular place, it's delivering more than we thought it would.
Now, is that also set up on the grid so that at times when they're producing more power than they need, they're adding the switches flip so that they're adding power back onto the grid?
I would be sure.
And then when they're not producing more power than they need, and they need it all, they flip the switch the other way so that they need to draw power from the grid that they can.
Yeah, you were describing the net metering law, and yes, I believe that is a part of this project.
Okay.
That's true for all of the photovoltaic systems that we put on, even residential. They run the meter backwards when they're producing more power than the house needs.
Right, and then
goes into the grid.
Okay, and then now another question I have, because you mentioned the local governments, and I want to make sure that I understand this correctly. Local governments. When you go in and do a project, whether it be like for a wastewater treatment plant or potable water distribution system and that sort of thing, what you do with them is a loan type of situation. So the local governments are expected to pay the money back, low interest at 1-3%, but still they're paying the money back. But for profit operations, we give them grants.
No.
Do I have that backwards, or am I correct in that, or help me
they are,
that?
Local governments are sometimes eligible and do participate in the state's low-interest loan program through the small-scale energy loan program. We do not
and
require
that,
them
that's,
to...
That's through the Department of Energy.
That's correct.
Okay.
And they do have that option.
Okay. What about the Energy Trust?
We do not have a loan program.
So any monies that you send to local governments, you're sending... It's a grant.
We're treating them the same. We are acquiring energy, and we're buying it.
And, Mr. Chairman, these are, maybe this is a picky thing, but these aren't grants. These are basically incentives to pay for the installation of energy-efficient measures. It's not a grant that they can do what they want to.
No, I understand. It's for a very specific purpose.
Very specific purpose.
But
yeah.
if you know, if you come to me and say, okay, Crummel, we'll give you $3,000 to make your home energy efficient, we've done an audit on your house, right, and you need new windows, and you need to put plugs in your vents, and you need to do this, and you need to do that, and there's a whole bunch of things that you say, and we're going to give you $3,000 to do that. So I take the $3,000, and now I have a and you tell me who to contract with, and I have a contract with that person. They come out and they do all the work, and then I pay them the $3,000, or you pay them the $3,000 without an expectation for me to pay it back. That to me is a grant. Now, it's a grant for a specific purpose. I understand that, but it still is, nonetheless, it is a grant.
Yeah.
You're not expecting me to pay it back. You're giving me the money. That's a gift.
Mr. Chairman, we look at it the same way as if you paid that money to the developer of a power plant. You're paying for the power that you get from him. We're paying the incentive, and in return we get the power at a much lower cost. So we see it as consistent with what happens when you would otherwise have taken that money and bought power from a power plant.
Okay. Well, I've been the recipient of a program in Wilsonville that was done about five or six years ago, and it was a terrific program. And it actually was based on water usage as opposed to electricity, but it did, but it has some electrical components to it because of items that were provided as part of it to try to reduce water use. So I'm not against it. I'm just questioning, and you know, it can become a matter of semantics.
Yeah.
Ms. Harris, you mentioned 20% lower energy costs. So help me understand this. If I, the PUC, those guys over there, hadn't raised my PGE rates, then my PGE rates would be, I got to blame somebody, you guys. Then my PGE rates would be 20% lower than they are now.
What I'm saying is that when people conserve energy and use energy more wisely through efficiency, they have that hedge against future rate increases, and they can reduce their current bills. What it means is they're recapturing that waste that they're otherwise paying for. So it's not a direct correlation with how much your rates go up. Your rates may go up for different reasons, but it's a way that you can manage and control the costs of that increase and the impact it has on you as a consumer.
When I read the little bar graph on my bill, and I see that in March of, let's go back to February, because I've already got that bill. In February of 2004, I expended a certain amount of energy on my electric bill.
Mm-hmm.
And my Northwest Natural bill is a good example, too, because it's more than doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not doubled the amount that I've used. As a matter of fact, it's been the same or less. But on my PGE bill, and I see that in February of 2004, I used 2,800 kilowatt hours. Is that right? And then, but in February of 2005, I used 2,000 kilowatt hours. I think I've got my measurements right. So I used 800 less, but my bill is higher than it was in 2004.
Mm-hmm. And your bill would be higher still if you hadn't used less, because you'd be paying for the increase in rates, and you'd be paying for what you didn't save.
Mr. Chairman, if
it's just a damn good thing I didn't use as much.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just a personal example. I just replaced my furnace in my house with an energy-efficient furnace. My gas bill was cut in half. My rate is the same. So, you know, what we're doing is lowering bills. And in shorthand people use, we're lowering the rate. What we're doing is lowering bills.
You mentioned, Ms. Harris, you mentioned the Washington companies, and I'm familiar with one in particular that's at the risk of making some other folks in the room angry at me. But I'm familiar with one in particular that's in the Camas area. And one person described it to me as having the extension cord running across the river and
underneath
and,
the river,
and plugging in.
Yeah.
My question is so this company is in Washington. They're not paying Oregon income tax rates. They're not paying Oregon anything. But they happen to be, because of this power line that goes under the river and over to them, they happen to be, for purposes of their meter and for purposes of their usage, they happen to be in the PGE, I think it's PGE's, service territory. So they are paying into the public purpose charge. And then in sort of in return for that, they're also getting a benefit, mm-hmm. because they've been able to, I believe, use a self-direct program to reduce their public purpose charge amount and make an investment in their facility. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in that?
I'm with you up until the very end, and I don't know if they're a self-directed customer. Perhaps the Department of Energy can answer that for you. They are a Pacific Power customer. They pay into the public purpose charge, and I believe we have done an energy efficiency project with them based on the contribution that they willingly make or have to make and then are eligible to get return from.
Yeah. So it's actually okay then for a facility to not be in the physical location of the of either the border of the state of borders of the state of Oregon, or to be in the actual service territory of PGE and Pacific Power, and still be able to benefit from the public purpose charge.
Mr. Chairman Cromwell, I know of no other example that has built a line under the river in order to not be a public power customer of the state of Washington.
Yeah.
And we actually carefully analyzed the exact same issues that you're raising to make sure we could serve them.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, they are in the service territory of Pacific Corp. Yeah. What we don't get when we do a project with Camas is the byproduct, the economic development in Oregon. Mm-hmm. We still get the same energy benefit, which is our charter. Pacific Corp otherwise would have been in the market to buy power at 5 or 6 cents to serve that load.
Right, you know, and you make the argument that they're still in the service territory as a Power Corp. So it's a whole dang town of Walla Walla, Washington. And they're in the whole service territory of
electrically.
Well, they are, yeah. so is the city of Walla Walla.
Well, yeah. We don't serve people in other states who are Pacific Power customers.
Right. Because they don't pay
the public purpose charge.
Because this operation in Camas is paying the public purpose charge because of their meter being on the Oregon side
That's
of the
true.
River.
Yeah. There's some interesting history about that, but it is a rare instance.
It's a rare bird.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Did the fund essentially have extra funds available that other facilities in Oregon couldn't access those funds? Or I guess what I'm asking is, you know, weren't there other businesses that would readily use that fund? Or did you have excess so that you could afford to go to Washington and not serve people only in Oregon?
There is no legal way for us not to serve them. They are eligible participants under the law. And there were sufficient funds to serve them and still serve the needs of Oregon businesses.
Of all other Oregon businesses?
Yes.
Okay.
So they were not in competition with an Oregon business, and they did not then, their actions did not lead to an Oregon business not being able to participate.
Okay. I have a... I'm sorry. Are you?
No.
I have an administrative question, and then I need to, and then we're going to need to go ahead and move on to some of our other folks that are going to be that are testifying. And that is one of the largest contracts is with I believe Aspen company, and another pretty good sized contract is with Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. And so when I was looking through the management audit report that TechMarket did, and on page 8 and 9, it lists a whole bunch of people that they interviewed for the management audit. And one of the people that they maybe I'm not on the right page here. Where did I see it? Anyway, one of the people that they talked to was, oh, here it is, Bob St. Armand, Aspen Systems, PMC Program Manager, Building Efficiency Program and Production Efficiency Program. They were, why would he be interviewed as part of the management audit? I'm trying to understand that. Not having read the complete audit at this point, I'm just wondering why that would be. He's not. I mean, none of these people that have worked for working for Aspen or used to work for Aspen are now working for the Energy Trust, are they?
No. I believe that Bob Sandemann was interviewed by the management auditors because the scope of work of the management audit included efficiency operations. And we have a contractual relationship with them. They are impacted by how swiftly we process their incentive payment requests. They are interested in how we do planning, how we select projects that meet our cost effectiveness criteria, and other aspects of our operation.
Okay. Kind of taking along with regards to that, then. Excuse me. One of the things that I believe the Energy Trust does is a rebate program. Is that correct?
We have an appliance rebate program. Yes.
So if somebody buys an appliance, they can get part of the cost of the appliance rebated, or all of the cost of the appliance rebated. Can you tell me how long does it take for, you know? So I go out and buy an appliance. Mr. Foley just bought his furnace, and so now he says, okay, I'm going to apply for a rebate through Energy Trust, because maybe the dealer told him that he could, and so on and so forth. So he applies today. When is he going to see that rebate check?
Within 30 days, averaging more like 2 weeks.
Within 30 days?
That's our usual turnaround time for payments.
Have you had complaints about turnaround time being too slow?
We just did an analysis, actually, at this gentleman's request of our comments on the website and inquiries from the call center. And occasionally, yes, we get calls about the status of an incentive check, but typically they run through very quickly.
Okay.
And that is true for payments to vendors as well.
Okay. You do try to get those kicked out the door, yeah. so vendors and folks aren't carrying.
I think that's a very important business element to abide by.
I would agree with you. Yeah. I think that's and if you can do a turnaround in less than 30 days, I think that's good. A little bit more information before I turn you loose with regards to a couple of administrative issues. One of the points that was made is, and I don't remember if it was Lee that made the comment, Lee Beyer, about your space, and that you're on the 12th floor of the Portland, or of a building in downtown mm-hmm. Portland. I don't remember the name of the building, but 6th and Oak, isn't it?
6th and Oak was our prior location.
6th and Oak was your prior location. Right. Your new location is where?
Broadway and Taylor, Mr. Chairman.
Broadway and Taylor. Mm-hmm. Now, I have some other information here, particularly from Cushman and Wakefield.
Mm-hmm.
Says that now, and I recognize that you're independent of the state, and so you can kind of make business decisions and do whatever you want to. But well, first of all, can you on your rental space? Can you tell me what your monthly payment is per month? I guess monthly payment per month would be.
The annual payment is about $290,000.
So that's roughly $19 a square foot annually.
$18.51 a square foot.
$18.51 mm-hmm. annually, which breaks down to about a dollar. If I'm doing the math correctly in my head, it breaks down to about $1.75 a foot. And somewhere in that neighborhood, and and you have about 15,000 square feet now.
That's correct.
Okay, and you have 30 employees.
34.
34 employees that work there. So 15,000 square feet divided by 34 is going to be roughly about, what, 300 square feet a person?
We also have on-site contractors, and we hold a great many training sessions and board meetings and advisory council meetings on-site. So a good portion of our space is meeting room space.
Okay.
And we achieve some savings by having those meetings on-site as opposed to having to rent space elsewhere.
Okay, so you have a boardroom,
yeah.
and you have a conference room or
right.
a couple of conference
right.
rooms and that sort of thing, and that's understandable. If if you said, hey, Cromer, we want you to come to work for us as a, I don't know, tech wiki or something, and we're going to put you in this space over here, how big of a workspace could I anticipate getting, either cubicle size or office size? Or
one of the benefits of this space is all the furniture and most of the offices were in place, and we did not have to acquire them and did not have to do very many tenant improvements. I would guess that all of our office spaces are roughly 12 by 10. They're not large offices, and the cubes that were there are circular cubes with low partitions, and they're all lined up, and they're typical of most cube spaces, 6 by 9, maybe more, 8 by 9.
8 by 9, so that's about,
yeah.
What, 72 square feet.
Also on site, we have an IT room, and an information technology room. We have many servers on site, and what was also advantageous about this space is that we didn't have to do any investment in capital practically for the wiring, and the room was temperature controlled appropriately, and we were able to move right in there.
So basically, it ended up being kind of a turnkey operation.
Yes.
And even though you were paying more in rent than you were paying at Sixth and Oak, I assume you were paying more anyway. Are you
actually,
paying?
It was the same.
It's the same. You mean 1851 square foot?
1850 compared to 1851 when you average it out.
Now, I noticed that in the report also that you have a, that there's a, that you still are leasing the space at 6th and Oak.
We sublet that space.
Okay, so you
so we broke even on that deal, and the arrangement of the current property owner is supposed to buy us out of our lease. The space we occupy had been vacant for 3 years, so we have an extremely competitive deal getting in when we did, taking advantage of the vacancy rates that are so high for commercial office space in downtown Portland. We looked at 37 buildings, and this was by far the most competitive lease arrangement.
Okay. Let me ask you this. If you could, was it as competitive, say, there as it would have been to go maybe to an area like Wilsonville or Hillsboro or Lake Oswego, the Cruise Way area, that sort of thing, or was it, would it have cost you more to move to one of those areas?
I think it would have cost us in other terms. It would have cost us in time of our employees commuting. It would have cost us in time for our board members and board meetings. We work with a number of other partners, and it's very convenient to be on the MAX line and to be in the downtown Portland area on buses, to be able to get to Northwest Natural, to Bonneville, to Portland General, to Pacific Power, to go right down one floor to the Power Planning Council. So in terms of central location, we get efficiencies from that as well.
Okay. You mentioned the MAX line, although it does run all the way to Hillsborough and then out to Gresham.
I know, I was a part of that.
And to North Portland. So where do your employees commute from?
Many of them live right in Portland.
Okay. Yeah. So then they just walk to work or ride.
Right. We have a very, very high percentage of people who use transit and who bicycle.
Okay. And and let me just go back to the lease for just a second, if I may. And that is, so you sublease the space out at Sixth and Oak to somebody else, and mm-hmm. they're paying the same rate there that you're paying there. So that's a wash. How much longer does that lease have to go? You'll be the
approximately 3 years, and I think they are. It pencils out so that there was a very minimal loss to us of the subleasing arrangement, and they are paying somewhat less than we paid, and that was an arrangement made with the owners of that particular building, not
through us.
They're paying less than you were paying?
Yes. I believe they are.
But the owner of the building is not charging you for the difference right. between what you were paying and what they're paying?
That's right. And that's the part that was, we were bought out of our lease from the people we currently rent space from. So it made up the difference for them. Just get us as an incentive to get us into the space that was vacant for them.
Okay. Okay. All right. Are there any other questions for Representative Anderson?
Thank you.
And I'll come over to Representative.
Decades ago, we had some visionaries that gave us hydroelectric power in Bonneville. And I understand there are major changes since that time. But we in environment have a net metering bill that probably will come to us or possibly to Chair Brown's committee. And seems to be a very wise investment. Have you considered investing in generation in small facilities, streams, you know, places where energy could be generated with the funds that you have in the energy trust?
We do invest in renewable generation, and hydro under certain requirements is considered a renewable investment from our portfolio standards. So yes, we do. We also invest in cogeneration or combined heat and power projects using biomass, and that's becoming increasingly powerful, increasingly popular, I should say. And we are currently exploring through our board and others a policy that would be larger scale generation using combined heat and power approaches where gas and electricity are involved.
Follow up. What percentage would you say you're investing in that end of power at this point?
A fairly small part of our overall renewable energy portfolio, probably around 5%.
Could we have a rollout here of the renewable part of your? We have a good summary of the conservation programs. We don't really have anything on the renewables. Could you get that to the board?
The renewable, the single largest element of our renewable portfolio is what we call utility scale programs, and I can make a copy of this information for the committee. The annual budget is $14.7 million, nearly $15 million, and that is acquiring the single largest amount of energy. Utility scale is primarily wind energy development. And when we say utility scale, we imply that it's in partnership with the utilities and their acquisition strategies as part of their integrated resource planning process through the Public Utility Commission. The second largest element of our program is solar electric, and that equates to about $3 million annually for the current year. The third is what we call wind cluster development, and it's tied also with biopower. And both of those are at $2.8 million. Biopower is one of the new programs that we're rolling out this year. And the last is open solicitation. And the open solicitation program is a doorway to any number of projects we may not otherwise have thought about. So it's a creative and innovative way to respond to ideas that people have using renewable energy, and that represents $2.1 million in the budget.
Just one follow-up. You mentioned wind was $14 million?
Large-scale wind is about $15
million. Wind cluster.
Those are smaller scale, might be one machine, 1 to 1.5 average megawatts. On up to maybe 5 or 10 of them. We also call it community scale wind.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond to Representative Anderson also? I think Representative Anderson, your question I think is extremely insightful. We talked earlier about some of the byproducts of the of what the trust does. One of those byproducts is to take relieve congestion on transmission and distribution through getting more distributed resources. And the commission has recently held two workshops, one on combined heat and power plants and the other on what is called non-wires alternatives to transmission and distribution, which are large expenditures and typically are only constrained a few hours a year, so that with these with these resources at the end use, they can make a major contribution over time, and the net metering that you're talking about is very important. We're looking at it very carefully and trying to figure out how, with the limited funds, we can make contributions in that area.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was a little bit unsure of the 6th and Oak. I wanted to get back to that. Was that the reason that that property was vacated? It was too small?
That's correct.
Okay. And how much smaller was it than the 15,000 square feet?
A little less than half. A little more than half as small. We more than doubled our space when we moved.
Okay. And had you doubled your number of employees? Or?
The space at 6th and Oak was designed for about 26 people. And we had not anticipated that it would be as unproductive a space for us longer term as it ended up being. So it was a very crowded space and a very loud space. So we have increased our productivity greatly by being in a more appropriately designed space.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
With regard to the buyout of the 6th and Oak, the difference on the 6th and Oak, there isn't any contingent liability if the new tenant fails to perform?
I don't know. Do you know? I can find out for you. I doubt that there is, and I would find out for you.
Would you just make sure that our committee staff is informed as to any contingency? Uh-huh. Because if I just hate to see you end up buying two different spaces, one that you couldn't use,
right,
one that's plenty ample.
Yeah, and my belief is that we're covered by the arrangement that we currently have, which it was more an increment of could we actually earn some money by subletting the space, because we were purchased out of that lease when we got into the new space.
Well, and I guess I'm not as anxious about that as I am the potential of any contingent liability. Mm-hmm. If the new tenant,
yeah,
is unable to perform the,
yeah,
the covenants of that, if you were in fact wholly and completely released from,
mm-hmm,
any further obligation,
yeah,
and so that would never come back on you.
Right. I will provide that information to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dinkle.
One question. Thank you. And I apologize if you covered this while I was out of the room, but I had a question about one of the benchmarks, Ms. Harris, the renewable resource development targets.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is outside of the discussion of the public purposes charge, but since part of your charge is to help promote renewable resources, can you just talk a little bit about how you do that? Is, in other words, do you do an RFP process where you say, we have this much money, we're looking for new sources of renewable, or do you know, how do you seek out partners to provide, mm-hmm, that alternative energy?
Good question, Representative Dean Calder. There are several different ways in which we acquire renewable energy resources. One is a competitive process, and that is largely dominated through the utility scale programs that we administer. Typically, a utility is required to file with the Public Utility Commission their plans for acquisition and how they will meet future demand. That's called an integrated resource plan. Within that, renewables are identified as a particular resource. We then go participate in the competitive request for proposals issued by the utilities and help evaluate the responses to that competitive process. And then we exercise our above market cost methodology, which is a negotiation tool to basically pay for not too much, but just enough to make the project go forward when it's compared to the cost of conventional resources. So we calculate that, we negotiate that with the developer, with the utility, and any other parties involved in that particular project. The other ways in which we work are the Open Solicitation Program, which is a simple two-page form on our website that just basically describes any ideas and invites those ideas to us from anyone in the state. Might be a business, might be an individual. And they describe their project, and it's a two-stage evaluation process. If it meets our test, if it qualifies under the law, then we go deeper into what it would cost to complete it. Do they have the information? Is the technology viable? And would it be eligible for our above market cost? And we negotiate that at an individual level. We also then provide incentives to individual businesses and individual homeowners or developers for the inclusion of solar and other renewables in their developments, integrated into the facades of buildings, integrated into their rooftops, a part of their whole acquisition and energy needs, and then we incent those also. And those are projects that just come forward through the availability of the incentives on the market.
Okay, and follow-up. How are you doing in meeting those targets?
Very, very well. In fact, last year we came over our goal. I believe it was 123% of goal, if I have that figure right, for renewable acquisition last year. We're actually moving faster in renewables than we are on the energy efficiency side, and that's because of the cooperation largely on the utilities, with the utilities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this probably goes back to some of the comments, and I was able to catch a portion of this while I was taking care of some other business, and apologize for being late. Back to the comments of the chair, Chair Beyer from the PUC, the allocation of the funds for the energy conservation, renewables, and schools, weatherization, and housing. Did Senate Bill 1149 provide any upper limit on administration, or was it silent on the administration cost to administer the?
I know of no specific dollar or percentage amount included in Senate Bill 1149. No, yeah. There is none.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative Butler. Thank you. And I assume from what I see in the audit reports here that it's run very much like an excellent business. Do you budget so that you have some percentage that you shoot for that you will not exceed in administration costs overall?
Yes, indeed we do, and in fact that's memorialized in the performance measure adopted by the Public Utility Commission, and the cap is at 11%, and we are below that.
Thank you.
I'm going to kind of follow up on that. When you say that the cap is at 11%, is that all administrative costs added in? So if the Department of Energy takes a cut, and like with the ESB, the Department of Education takes a cut, and somebody else takes a cut, and so pretty soon it's, you know, ramped up to where, you know, half of what you're spending is being paid out in its admin costs. Or is that just the performance measure as far as the energy trust is concerned?
It is the latter.
Okay. I have a question with regards to the projects and the payback. In looking through January 10, 2005 report to us on the expenditures, because some of these, look like, I mean, if you do real simple math, it looks like that the energy savings and the payback and the amount of the expenditure, you know, range anywhere from a couple of years to up to about 18 or 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
In general, when you're looking at a project, is the life of the project going to extend longer than the estimated payback?
The life of the project.
Well, in other words, as an example, I'm going to pick on the ESBs for a second. Now, I recognize that you don't specifically administer that. Let me pick on one that you do administer. I don't remember where I put my project list. Let's go to Blue Heron. Let's go to Blue Heron for a minute. So you're $5.4 million into that. And they're going to save, what did we decide? They're going to save, a boatload of money on their energy costs. Oops, I don't remember exactly.
Mr. Chairman, as I remember, the number is about $5 million a year.
Yeah, $5 million a year.
$5 million per year on energy costs.
Oh, they are going to save $5 million per year on energy costs?
That's my recollection.
So being $5.4 million into it, the payback on that's very quick then, in terms of maybe that was a bad example. obviously in that case the life. That's an okay example to use because the life of that project, the life of that investment, the equipment that you're buying, the lights that you're buying, the ballasts, the so on and so forth that you've provided into that plant. Guesstimated life expectancy of 5 years, 10 years,
30,
35 years,
30.
If I might, Mr. Chair, we've had this discussion several times, and it's on the agenda for one of the next policy committee meetings. Here's the issue: we have a goal of building a 300 megawatt conservation power plant that is equivalent to the 400 megawatt capacity gas-fired. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to meet that goal, we have to have measures that last 30 years. Some of the measures we put in, like energy-efficient light bulbs, might last 5 years. So we have to make a decision: are those light bulbs going to be replaced in kind or better by the participants without our contribution? And if the answer to that is no, we have to reinvest in 5 years into those measures. They're still cost effective for us to invest, but if we think that we've moved the technology to the point where they will be replaced in kind or better, we've met our goal of a 30-year long measure. If we think that they won't be replaced in kind or better, we'll reinvest because it's cost effective for us to do so. And so that's how we're going to get to the point where it's equivalent to the 30-year life of the power plant.
I think I can add for a moment another complementary piece to what Tom is describing, and that is it should be included in your thinking, the benefit provided to the businesses about how they think of energy efficiency. Once they do a project like this, they're back and interested in doing more. And what happens is a shift in their thinking about the value of energy as a cost center, and how they can effectuate change and reduce that cost center and then use what they save and would otherwise have been paying on energy for some other competitive advantage in their business. So what we're noticing now is the people on the shop floor are getting the attention of the CFO and the CEO of the organizations, and I'll gladly pay for that if you want me to. And coming in as a part of the decision-making about that company's strategy and how to be more competitive. So part of what's being imparted here is information useful in the business minds of our corporations and helping them be more competitive and stay in business.
Mr. Chair, an anecdote related to me by the representative from Providence Hospitals who's taken part in these programs. He said through these programs he's been able to convince his board. The hospital has a 2% profit margin. Every dollar he saves is equivalent to $50 of new business in the front door. And they finally get it, he said, which has been interesting and enlightening for him and his board. So a dollar saved in energy is equivalent to $50 of new business coming in the door.
We also look at every individual measure that we fund, and by law, it has to be cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
So we will only fund those things that have a reasonable investment and a reasonable payback from our standpoint of acquiring low-cost energy resources. So everything has to pass that muster.
Representative Post,
one chair, a question, Mr. Chair, relative to that, and I'm still interested in the administration. Do you have to go out and seek for those, or again, you're saying these are more and more coming through the doors? I assume that in your administration costs, there's all in-state travel, no out-of-state travel to seek these projects.
We are not having difficulty acquiring projects. Our pipelines are full, and most of the way in which a person comes through the door of the Energy Trust is through a trade ally, a business on the ground in the local community working with other businesses, or a contractor that we are working with who's in the field throughout the state. And they are out there identifying projects that people increasingly are also hearing about us on the web, which is a very efficient means of communicating. And then they make their decisions and contacts with trade allies locally. So there's not a lot of travel involved, and there's certainly no out-of-state travel involved in recruiting projects.
Margie, it may be helpful to describe the trade ally network and for the members.
Oregon is very plentiful in terms of businesses that can aid the goals and the mission of the Energy Trust. We have architecture, engineering firms, small businesses who do weatherization and insulation contracting, solar contractors and inspectors, people who analyze the value from an engineering perspective of different opportunities. And we've attracted that expertise, and we've leveraged that expertise.
That's Oregon-based.
They're all Oregon-based. There are 400 such trade allies. They come to us for training, so there's some travel to Portland, and we provide training also elsewhere in the state. We do that sometimes in tandem with the utilities and the account representatives from the utilities, opening the door to their customers, being the face of the opportunity that's available to their customer to save energy. The trade allies learn about the incentives that are available and how to market that program and how we would then complete the deal or seal the deal that they identify.
And Mr. Chairman, members, these trade allies, 400 or
yeah.
so, have signed agreements with the trust and to maintain their quality assurance training. So it's a nice organization, and it's a way to bring a lot of projects to the trust.
And then we go check their work.
We check their work.
Help me understand something. I had a project I think is just a great project, and so I want to apply. Take me from start to finish, you know, where I make the first call, and then you tell me what I need to do, and I do it, and let's say I do it in a pretty timely fashion, and then at some point in time, you're either going to say, yep, you're right, great project, we're funding you X number of dollars, or, you know, nope, great project, but not something we're going to cover, so your application's denied. Mm-hmm. What kind of a time frame am I looking at there? Kind of walk me through that.
Well, one of the ways that the programs are working and why they're so simple is we have a pre-approved list of measures that we will pay for. And we have an incentive dollar amount for those measures. So it's very easy to find out what those are, either by looking at the website, calling our call center, which is an 800 number or 866 number, or talking to someone who is a trade ally who's familiar with those incentives. If the project is larger and more complex, we do a technical analysis and study of where the opportunity lies, what the cost of the individual measures or equipment replacement might be, cost that all out, and then we give an incentive per kilowatt hour saved. So all of that process can be very immediate if you're a homeowner and you want to put in a new furnace, and it's within 30 days you have your $200 incentive check back for high-efficiency furnace models that are approved. No bureaucracy associated with that, no steps really hard for you to navigate, and it's very straightforward and simple. If you're a business, you can make those same kind of decisions about lighting in a very short turnaround period. And again, there's often a barrier for the customer who knows they could save energy but needs some help deciding what kind of bulbs to put in, what kind of expertise and opportunities exist, and that's where that trade ally interface comes. So they're doing that rather quickly on site, maybe 45 days to 60 days worth of analysis depending upon the scale and complexity of the project, and then incentives are issued very soon after completion. If it's a large project, we actually pay incrementally as milestones are met, and that's what we're doing with Blue Heron.
So as some of their milestones are hit, then you release the money.
That's right.
For it. That does bring up another interesting question that, and Mr. Foley, you sort of alluded to, some of the projects that you're doing are really kind of long-term projects, and I understand that. But and especially, and again, I recognize that you don't administer the ESD programs. If I remember correctly, Senate Bill 1149 for the public purpose charge has a sunset for the public purpose charge of I think it's 2009 or
2010. 2012.
I stand corrected. Basically, it was from the time that it was supposed to be started to it's a 10-year window. What happens if the 2011 legislature says, that'll be what, the 81st, says, great idea, but we decided we don't want to do this anymore, or we don't want ratepayers having to pay this 3% anymore, yada, 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 boom, sunset's going to take effect. They're not going to repeal, they don't mm-hmm. repeal the sunset. What happens? What happens to some of these projects?
We would be winding down, and I believe the grant agreement with the Public Utility Commission asked the question you're raising in 2009, so that we can begin to the transition, if that is the case, and we would, I assume, stop taking any new projects and close out and transition out of business, if that were the case.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, from the board's perspective, we hope we leave a good legacy if that happens.
Okay, we don't know what the 2011 legislature will decide, but on anything, we don't know what the 2005 legislature will decide on a lot of things. So it's so anything is up in the air. But I'm just wondering because of the fact that some of these projects really are long term projects. I mean, when you're talking to a company, for example, about setting up a wind farm in Northeast Oregon, and there's going to be $15 million or whatever it is amount of money that from you folks over the course of 5 years or 10 years and that sort of thing, and the company themselves are going to be making another $85 million investment and what's and the incentive and I think that really is a valid question to ask. You know, one of the purposes for doing this hearing is to really get kind of a middle ground look at where the Energy Trust is going, has gone, as well as our other departments and partners in how this money is distributed and put out. I recognize that 2007 is when you're supposed to have a full blown audit, but I think from a legislative perspective, it is good for us to take this midway look and mm-hmm. just kind of mm-hmm. see what's going on. We are going to run out of time, members, and for the folks that we've invited to testify, we're going to run out of time because I can't get all of you in 3 minutes. I could try, but I think it would probably not do you justice for us. So I'm going to ask if the folks that are slated to testify, which would be next, which would be our would be Mike Graney and David McKay and folks from the ESDs, housing and in the Citizens Utility Boards and in talking about the self-directed projects. I'm wondering if we can delay that until next Thursday. Repine's shaking his head. That's all right. He'll just send Jack in. But I would like to delay. I would like to delay that to next Thursday, and we'll make it a time certain. And members, if we can, I'd like to start as close to on time as we can. I know we all try to get here by 8:30. We all have things that we do early in the morning. And I would also like to invite the Energy Trust folks to come back. I don't think I'll start with you on Thursday, but I would like to have you available if you don't mind coming back next Thursday mm-hmm. to be to answer questions that may come up. And
be happy to do that.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
To talk about this.
We appreciate you being here. Thank you very much. And so we'll see you all next Thursday. And so with that, we will stand adjourned.